First question, how's the campaign going? You know, you're coming down to the home stretch, so how's it going?
12 days to go, and we're very confident that we're going to win on June 14th, and we feel great about the entire last 6 months, but we've traveled 16,000 miles across North Dakota on the ground, held events in 63 different cities, hundreds of events in 63 cities, met thousands of North Dakotans, and through that process, I got a good feel for the mood of the state and what people are feeling, and in the northwestern part of the state, understanding that people are hurting, during this downturn, understanding what the needs are of people, and people've got, you know, the stories are inspiring, and people's passion and perseverance and optimism, all that's great. But I truly believe in the future of our state, but we got some challenges right now, and I think the first responsibility of a leader is to acknowledge the problems, because that's the only way you can solve them. So I feel great about the campaign, but I'm excited about the opportunity to have a chance to lead this state.
You've made a few tours out to Western North Dakota. Speaking of challenges,
yep.
What are your thoughts of the activity, either pre-boom, post-boom, during the boom? Just your thoughts of Western North Dakota.
Well, first of all, energy has been amazing for North Dakota. It's such an essential part of what we've been able to accomplish, and it's an essential part of where we're going to, for us to be able to reach our potential as a state. We've been blessed with all these natural resources, and certainly we've been blessed with the resource of the soil, but being blessed with what's beneath is incredible. And of course, the advances of technology that has allowed us to tap into this, much of that technology pioneered right here, mm-hmm. has been incredible. It's changed the dynamics of politics in the world based on what, hardworking men and women have done in North Dakota. So it's amazing. But we have to figure out how to make sure we're managing that resource wisely, so that we're at the city level, the county level, the state level, and for the private companies that have come in and taken all the risk. Think of the amount of capital, mm-hmm. these companies have deployed, the amount of talent that's been attracted here. I'm a private sector guy, and believe me, I appreciate that these oil companies have a choices about where their capital flows. I've led and worked in a global company. These oil companies are all global companies. They can choose where they place their capital, and we have to make sure that we've got an operating environment here in North Dakota that's attractive for people to deploy their capital.
Governor Schaefer referred to the Bakken as a technology boom. You mentioned technology. What are your thoughts and comments on that? It's not an oil boom, it's a technology boom.
Well, it is. And when you think about when we've had, a lot of things, politically can affect prices of oil, and it's a global market. So you've got political disruption or fear that can drive markets, but it's also supply and demand is the fundamental driver of any market. And I spent my whole life growing up being told that we're going to run out of oil. From the minute mm-hmm. I left high school, through my whole life, we're going to run out of oil. Every expert, every book, every projection, every author. And then where are we at now? The world's awash in oil. And part of the reason we're awash in oil is because the technology, both with, the horizontal drilling and the hydraulic fracturing, which has allowed us to tap into shale oil plays, not just in the Bakken, but all over the world, has really changed the supply dynamic in the world, and that's an interesting thing. It's good for the United States for sure that we've had a resurgence in oil production in the United States. But again, it's technology driven, and if you take a look at the new technologies that are coming, that allow us to have the drilling be more accurate, the fracking to be more productive. The future looks very bright because we can keep lowering our marginal cost of production. Through technology is going to allow us to continue to be competitive, because in a world with excess supply, marginal cost matters.
Isn't that crazy? 10 years ago, peak oil, today, a glut of oil in the marketplace?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
No, I'm just glad I didn't spend my life writing peak oil articles, because you'd be like, to basically have to find out that something that you held dear mm-hmm. as a principle was just absolutely not true. But technology does this to people, not just in oil, but look at ag. We're going to run out of food. When I was a kid, we're going to run mm-hmm. out of food. There's going to be too many people in the world. Population explosion. We're all going to starve to death. And now we got American farmers that are, so productive that we've actually got still have declining rural populations in some part of our state, even as our output and production increases and increases. But again, the technology, I mean, look, the, you know, these Case IH quad tractors that are, you know, manufactured right here in Fargo, you know, they got more technology on that machine than we had on the lunar lander. You know, that's, and that's not a joke. I mean, it's not an exaggeration. I mean, it's, it is a incredible, the technology that we're packing into both, you know, both oil and agriculture.
I always give the example of the punch cards. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to do, you probably remember the old punch card days. So, I mean, from punch cards to the Apple IIc to, you know, here the iPad. Where's North Dakota going with technology?
Well, it's, this is a, you know, one of the reasons I'm running, because I've been talking about we have a changing economy, mm-hmm. but I, when I describe that, it's changing in two ways. One is that we're in a position of, you know, we're, you know, really in a position of a downturn or a recession, however you want to call it. So we have to acknowledge that, and we have to right-size government to match, you know, the flows of dollars that are coming into government. But the second thing, which is not temporary, which is a permanent change in the economy, is that we're moving into a digital economy. Mm-hmm. And when you've got, when a digital economy occurs, it affects every job, every company, every industry, and it also affects, it should be affecting, you know, every government service. Because right now, you know, there's a lot of barriers called regulation, which slow down, you know, how rapidly we're changing education or how rapidly we're advancing healthcare because of regulation. But those are also industries where the United States spends a lot of money, which also we can get higher productivity and better output through the application of technology in everything that government does.
How can we usher that in? This, it's really a new era, mm-hmm. and really it is a fast-paced new era and an old guard.
Yes.
And I mean, it's interesting when you look at how energy's been able to really bring in a new era of technology. They got walking rigs now, you know. Yes. These rigs walk 10 feet to the next hole, they punch it in. And that's kind of how I'm looking at politics right now, mm-hmm. to where we have a new era of politics, yet there's an old guard there. And that was a little bit of your platform a little bit, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is you know, the June 14th election is going to give people a very clear choice. It's going to be a mm-hmm. choice between, you want someone who's defending the status quo, or do you want someone who's going to harness all the power of the future for the benefit of everyone?
Hmm. Well, getting back to the energy questions, we just sidebar there for just a second, but, you know, back in 2012, when oil prices were at $100, the Bakken was a frenzied pace. People were paying $15 for sandwiches. They didn't care. So flash forward a few years, and people are starting to tighten their belt. But the infrastructure is being done out there. You know, I heard somebody mention that, you know, the four lanes from Williston down to Dickinson, which I was a part of that, the two-lane highways, which were very, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. I left Highway 22 because I was not a trucker. I said, I got no business being on this road, get off it. Mm-hmm. Now I feel safe driving on those roads. I lead into that by saying, how important is the infrastructure in Western North Dakota to the overall state economy?
Well, it's absolutely essential, and it does, as you say, it starts with public safety. I've been going to Western North Dakota for 45 years. I've been a landowner in Slope County for 20 years, and you know, one of the sad things about, you know, some of that infrastructure, you know, came after that tragic accident where the three young, you know, rodeo mm-hmm. Guys were killed, you know, coming home from a rodeo one night. Well, two of those three were the sons of one of my neighbors, you know, out in Slope County. You know, I was at their, you know, funeral in the Bowman Rodeo Ground, saddest funeral I've ever been to in my life. You know, and again, you know, two-lane road, and, you know, at night, I mean, it's a dangerous situation. So, I mean, I think it's great that we've got infrastructure out there, you know, not only to support the industry, but also to, you know, make sure that we're taking care of public safety. So one thing we have done well with the surge funding, because the surge funding, which again came from an entirely different bucket. We're not talking about the general fund where we really have let spending has gotten away from us. But in the surge funding, which was the Strategic Infrastructure and Improvement Fund, that was money that came from oil extraction, oil production taxes that was intended to go back to those oil producing counties, and spending over $1 billion, giving it back to communities with local decision making, local control, is exactly, you know, what needs to happen. And the only thing that my running mate, Mayor Brent Sanford, who you know, mm-hmm. Mayor of Watford City, would, you know, we might have said, hey, let's have the formula. So instead of sending the money to Bismarck and sending it back, let's just keep more of it locally in the first place. So that local communities are always going to know where to spend the next dollar in infrastructure because they're there. And those are decisions that can be made in real time as opposed to every 2 years in Bismarck. But, you know, we are in much shape. When the industry returns and oil prices return, you know, we're going to be in much better shape in Western North Dakota than we were before because of the infrastructure that we have put in place.
Is that part of your platform, is to take a look at that ratio policy where it goes to Bismarck and comes back? Because the North Dakota oil and gas producing counties last year spent a small fortune trying to lobby to get a higher percentage. They didn't get all they wanted. They got a little bit.
Yep.
But is that part of your platform?
Well, we've said, Brent and I have said, everything needs to be on the table, you know, because we're leaving an era of abundance, you know, where money was coming in beyond above the forecast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're entering an era where every month, you know, we're coming in below the forecast. And again, we're, you know, cumulative, we're off by over $1.1 billion, you know, just in the you know, less than the first 12 months of the biennium, we're off by, you know, that much, and it continues to grow. So, you know, when you've got that big of a shortfall between what your projected spending was and projected revenue, and I should say, and it really wasn't, the revenue is overstated because part of that spending was predicated on taking our beginning balance from $700 million down to $300 million for an ending balance. So that's another $400 million that was coming out of the checking account. Now that's going to be consumed. So the checking account is going to go from 700 to zero. We had a rainy day fund of 575. That's going to be gone before we even get into the second year of the biennium. And so the next time when we come into session, we are not going to have, the cushion is gone. The checking account is empty and the savings account is empty. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on us really thinking, how do we reinvent and how do we streamline? I mean, this isn't a belt tightening exercise. This is a reinvent government exercise.
As long as we're talking about the budget numbers a little bit, the trend has been for the last 15 years for governors to increase their budgets.
Right.
I think there might be one or two examples where there's a 5% cut. I think at one point Governor Hovind then had a 5% cut, and I think maybe the last budget might have been down. But the trend has been to increase the governor's budget. What does a budget look like under a Burgum gubernatorial administration?
Well, I think it's just going to have to face the reality. I mean, Governor Dalrymple has already ordered the departments to start looking at a 10% reduction, you know, versus last time. So we know that the starting point is going to be down mm-hmm. From the last session. It's just a question of how far it's going to be. And I think, again, we're not going to have additional economic information until after June 14th. We know we're going to have a new revenue forecast, you know, made in August. You know, but right now, again, we've been missing by a lot. You know, not a little. I mean, in March, 2 years ago, the revenue that came in the state was $204 million. This March, it was $98 million, 52% off. And April was, you know, similar thing. So these aren't 4% or 10% misses. I mean, we're missing substantially because when the price of oil went down, not only did the oil extraction production taxes went down, but we also saw a huge drop in sales tax. And then we've seen a drop in corporate income tax, and we're seeing a drop in personal income tax. So the model, you know, that was being used to forecast didn't encompass the ripple effect, you know, through all the different forms of tax revenue. And then it also didn't account for the fact that we were going to end into a cycle of being really down in ag commodity prices, because every ag producer in the state, you know, across the state, including the northwestern part of the state, they're all looking at cost of production that's going to be higher than what their expected revenue is going to be. And if you're staring that, you're staring down that barrel, you're not buying a new truck, you're not buying a new combine, you know, probably spending, I mean, our family's still is in the grain elevator and agronomy business, and so we know, I mean, farmers even, you know, they even sometimes buy, you know, less fertilizer and chemical if they feel like they put less inputs in if they think they're not going to get as much out. So everything is down in our economy right now. Unfortunately, both oil and agriculture are heading down at the same time, and that's really causing a double whammy for the state of North Dakota's revenues.
Do you see a ripple coming through with that? I mean, I wrote an article called The Reverse Ripple, and it had to do with oil, meaning that when oil prices came up, we felt the ripple all the way through to, you couldn't find a tank in Fargo Tank.
Right.
Minneapolis was a huge success of the economic boom in North Dakota. Now we're kind of seeing the reverse ripple on that. Do you feel the ag and we'll call it mining of oil, is going to have a reverse ripple through the state?
Well, you know, during this downturn, I mean, I think it's already happening. As you take a look at, I know in communities that I've been traveling through in the you know, in the Bakken, I mean, I'm traveling on the ground. I'm staying in hotels. I'm asking people, hey, tell me about your occupancy. I mean, people are, you know, saying, hey, we're at 25%, but they're at 25%, but they're at half the rack rate that they were 2 years ago. So if they've gone from $200 a night to, you know, $99 a night at 25%, they're actually trying to run that motel at one-eighth the revenue. Mm-hmm. And if they built it during the Bakken premium, I mean, you know that people are hurting. And so it's a question of, I mean, part of that ripple effect is what's going to do to the real estate market, whether it's home prices or, you know, commercial real estate, hotels, apartment buildings. I mean, you know, it appears that in some cases we've got overcapacity, and that overcapacity is, some of that's going to be picked up, that slack can be picked up by dropping prices until it meets demand, but we just, you know, we may, until we see activity pick up, we may have overbuilt.
How about flaring? I don't know if you're familiar with flaring, but the governor sits on the Industrial Commission, so the governor has to be somewhat familiar with it. From an environmental to the aesthetic to even the mineral ownership of the natural gas being flared out there. Do you have a thoughts or opinion when it comes to the flaring in North Dakota?
Well, absolutely, and this is, of course, this is an area where the state's made a lot of progress. I mean, during the peak of the boom, we were flaring, upwards of 30%, but we didn't have the infrastructure. We had, the gathering pipelines had to be put in, the gas plants had to be built, and I think now we're down under 10%, so we've made a lot of progress. Some of that is because of the downturn. That's allowed us to catch up a little bit. But as you said so articulately, I mean, this affects, mineral owners are losing revenue opportunities. We're losing, the business opportunities. I've sort of said, half serious, half jokingly, we should be advertising around the world if anybody wants free energy, come to North Dakota. I mean, what could we do with, Iceland, of all places, is basically growing all their own food. They used to be totally dependent on imports, and now they've taken geothermal, built all these amazing greenhouses because their geothermal is essentially free, and they're raising food. And I walk into a grocery store here in Bismarck or Minot, and I look at the blueberries, and they've come from Chile, and the raspberries have come from Mexico, and I'm like, people say it's too cold in North Dakota, but if you got free energy that we're burning off, what uses could we use that for? And again, half joking, half serious, but again, I think it's, again, there's a loss, there's an opportunity cost, to us if we're not utilizing that. I think that one of the things on the flaring, of course, is, the way we reduce flaring is gathering pipelines, but, pipelines have to cross people's property, and you've got to get right away to do that. So this is a systems problem. It's not just the oil companies. It's also about the gas companies, the pipeline companies, the landowners. Everybody's got to come together to solve this problem, but it appears that we're making good progress on it.
Do you have any solutions for the issue, whether it be more public comments? Because they've kind of removed some of the public comments when it comes to pipelines and some of the energy issues, unless you're a landowner or unless you are directly affected by it. With the pipelines, whether it's eminent domain, I've even heard that word thrown out a few times. What are you hearing from landowners or from pipeline companies that have to involve pipelines?
Well, I've had a chance to meet multiple times with different landowner groups, in Stanley and in Williston and up by Kenmare. I mean, and there's, and again, I'm a landowner myself. I've got some land near Epping. I got the land down in Slope County, but it's just really important. I mean, this country, our country was built on private property rights, and that has to be a pillar of how we, how we advance ourselves in our country, that we have to respect private property rights, we've got to defend private property rights, and we have to go through all the right kind of due process to make sure that people that, own property and pay taxes on those properties every year, that they have an opportunity to have a say in what's going on, on their property and in their neighborhoods. And I believe that's part of the public discourse, is to make sure that we've got, the appropriate input from all the people that are affected by these decisions. And, the landowners that I've met, they're all pro-energy, but they also want to make sure that their land is taken care of. You know, they don't want to be obstructionists. They want to figure out a way to work in collaboration, because we have to have that. You know, their asset is the soil, and we have to take care of that soil in perpetuity, because, you know, and we've got the asset, the mineral asset below, but we got to take care of both parties. We can do that.
How about when it comes to the spills, number of spills, whether it's saltwater spills, Yellowstone and Missouri River have gotten some spills in there. I want to even think Watford City had some spills near there. Whether it's from a regulatory or a cleanup or an environmental, what are your thoughts when it comes to how the state has handled the spills?
Well, this is an area where I think we have room for improvement. And part of it is just even starting with, you know, with the data collection. I think that, you know, when I've talked to people on the ground in the local communities, the emergency services, disaster recovery folks, you know, there's a question on whether or not we've got good data or not on, you know, on spills. And some of that is, you know, at the pace that we were going and the systems we have, because it's not that we all often have hardworking people want to do the right thing, but the state of North Dakota right now, there can be as many as four different agencies when you go between the, you know, the NDIC, the PSC, the health department, and others, not to mention local jurisdictions. I mean, sometimes a company might have to report a spill in four different databases, and those databases aren't interconnected in any way. And so then you end up with let's do a report on how we're doing on spills, or which database we're going to use. I can guarantee that those databases don't match up with each other. And so, you know, so then, you know, what do we really know, or where are our blind spots? And I'm a guy that likes to focus on results, set a mission, set a goal, achieve results. But you can't do that unless you have the right instrumentation. The right instrumentation starts with making sure you got accurate data. So we have to make sure that we're collecting the right kind of data. But when you get into, you know, in the spills, again, when I've toured landowners, I mean, I've seen spills where, you know, just a week ago I was up looking in a field, you know, and there's the crop up, and then you got 31 acres where there's no crop growing. I mean, it was a saltwater spill. And, you know, that farmer talked to someone who's been, you know, he's mortgaged his house, sold land, he's maybe $250,000 in debt trying to fight a lawsuit, you know, to get his 31 acres back. And, you know, and again, I think those are the kind of stories, you know, that hurt the entire industry. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so we have to make sure that we're, you know, balancing the needs of the landowners, you know, making sure that we're taking care of the environment. But those are things that that's something we can do together. I mean, and I think it's in the best interest of the industry, and it's the best interest of North Dakota to make sure that we're balancing all those, you know, those principles.
Let's transition that into the UAS industry. That's one of the industries I believe that's going to bridge the north and or the east and the west together quite a bit. I remember a couple of years ago they were I sat in a meeting with the Industrial Commission, and they were having manual planes, people actually still in planes flying over doing some surveillance, and that was a little shocking to me, because we're at a place pretty close, if not there now, to where drones and UAS can be doing that for us. And we've got this whole eastern side that has grown significantly over the last 10 years, not just the last 3 years,
right,
but it's been growing for 10 years on this side of the state. And do you see where a day where the UAS industry is going to, in fact, I think President Obama signed something in law several years ago that there'll be like 10,000 UASs in the sky by 2020. Mm-hmm. So we're progressing there. Do you see the day where we'll use UASs out in the Bakken on a daily basis or a weekly basis?
The answer is yes. But let me even take it up a level above that, because the big era that we're moving into is an era of automatically collected data. I just got done talking about, you know, spill reporting. And when I say spill reporting, I'm pretty sure everybody has in their mind a clipboard and a piece of paper, a white form that looks like a government tax form, and somebody with a pen, you know, writing it out and mailing it in to somebody. And that's the way people think about data collection. And it turns out that humans are actually not very good at data collection. Mm-hmm. And it's also very expensive. If you're taking a petroleum engineer and having to fill out that form, you know, not the highest and best use of their time. In the same way, this has occurred in healthcare with a bunch of federal regulations where we've turned, you know, our highest paid, highest trained people in healthcare, all of our doctors and nurses, and if you have a loved one or yourself who's been to the doctor in the last 5 years, you know what they're doing. They're not looking at you. They got their hands on a keyboard, mm-hmm. you know, because we've turned them all into data entry. And turns out that, you know, doctors, they didn't go to school for that. They're not good at it. You know, we couldn't read their handwriting when they're writing prescriptions. Turns out they're not good at data entry either. I mean, because we're human. So, you know, one of the companies I'm involved with in healthcare is focusing on automatically collecting data, you know, on, you know, location and status and temperature. You know, is it sterile? Is it clean? Is it dirty? Is it on? Is it off? Is it, you know, is it you know, in the cabinet or is it left the cabinet? Is the temperature, you know, this fridge on or off? Hundreds of applications in healthcare and in, you know, and just in an 8-hospital area for the Veterans Administrator, we're tracking 435,000, I mean, down to scalpels, you know, and the scalpel, you know, can have a 2D etching on it and go through 1,000 watch cycles, and we can still tell when that thing's passing underneath the reader where it is and which scalpel it is and which surgeries it was involved in. I mean, so the level of automatic data collection that's available with the computing power and the digital stuff we have today is amazing. Now let's apply that to the Bakken, you know, and then throw UAVs on top of it, which is where I'm going, is because a UAV is just a vehicle for data collection, is the way I would think about it. I mean, yes, it can fly. Yes, the battery power is going to get stronger. Yes, the accuracy is going to get higher, but it's like, you know, infrared and cameras and, you know, the visual stuff. And so, I mean, there's so many things, but then the kinds of things I talk about in healthcare, you know, again, on pipelines, I mean, I envision a day where, you know, we're going to have, you know, not just, you know, metering on the, you know, on the flows and pressure gaugers, but you might have something every 10 meters, you might have something, and people say, oh, that's way too expensive. No, the cost of these automatic sensors, you know, are going to be in the pennies when they start getting. I mean, we've already got in agriculture, we got people that are putting, you know, one in every ear of every cow. I mean, they're building these things out, in the units, tens of millions of type units. When you're building at that scale, then the cost is pennies. And so if we're talking about pennies, I mean, think about the automatic sensors you could have collecting information versus, you know, hiring one more state employee, you know. And yes, we need real people to interpret the data, but we don't need to pay people to do data collection when we can do it automatically. And then you talk about rail safety, you throw this in there. I mean, I was with at a keynoting at a tech conference, and the CEO of Burlington Northern was at the same conference, and he was describing that they've got this sound array that they put on side of a railroad track, and it's about 20 meters long, both sides, trains going by at 70 miles an hour, and they can detect if a bearing is, if a wheel's cracked or a bearing is going to go out through the sound that it's making. Okay, well, a rail inspector walking past a parked train can't see that with a human eye, but they can pick it up by the sound it makes. So again, that's, you know, there are dozens of examples of we're entering into a world with the digital era is going to produce all kinds of automatically collected data, and that's going to unleash all kinds of information that we never had before, and that's going to, you know, improve safety, reduce spills, give us more data to make decisions, help us make better, you know, with predictive analytics, you know, on that data we can make better decisions about, you know, what to do next. It changes everything, but this is, you know, it's been talked about as big data.
We're talking big data,
but the reason how you get big data is in that, back in that healthcare example, if you got 435,000 objects, all of which are speaking to you automatically every 5 seconds, going, here I am, I'm clean, I'm dirty, you know, that's a lot of data that you're generating. You know, that's not, you know, that's humans generate very little data. Humans with clipboards are just super slow and super inefficient. Automatically generated data, it's accurate and it's large, and that gives us an opportunity with the computing power and the storage we have, plus in the cloud. I mean, we can do this stuff virtually. You know, it's a whole new world, and it's so I get very excited about it, because I think there are going to be so many applications for us to apply in the Bakken when we're talking about big geography with lots of activity across, you know, lots of functions happening. It's the perfect application for it, and we could lead the world in it. Why wouldn't North Dakota be the showcase of how to apply all this technology?
And you see this in agriculture as well. I mean, last time I talked to Commissioner Goring, he was talking about the biodegradable sensors that they put in the ground, and they speak to the UAVs as you come over. And so what's coming down the path is real-time big data. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was at the Drone Focus Conference here in Fargo yesterday, which is, you know, going to be the Williston, you know, Basin Petroleum Conference in 5 years. My prediction is this Drone Focus thing. I mean, I think we had 350, 400 people this thing, from all our people from NASA, you know, people from all over the country here in Fargo for this conference. But of course, big representation from NDSU and UND, because, you know, between the aviation background at UND and the agricultural research at NDSU, plus the fact that people like Senator Hovind, who've been out in front of this thing, advocating, getting the airspace approved from the FAA. I mean, we can do things here, in this Northern Plains airspace, and what's going on with in Grand Sky, in the conjunction between the Air Force Base mm-hmm. and Grand Forks, and I mean Northrop Grumman, McDonnell Douglas, these guys are building big buildings up there. I mean, we've got the right kind of players coming in for us to actually build a huge industry in North Dakota.
These are the biggest players in the game.
Absolutely, yeah. The biggest. And yeah. We're not talking about four rotor blade things that carry your GoPro camera up for 20 minutes. I mean, they've got things up there that are flying that have got 40-foot wingspans. Mm-hmm. But when you do that, well, then all of a sudden now you can be mapping, entire sections of agricultural fields, with infrared reflective light, all kinds of things. And we're going to have so much data around agriculture that we've never had before, but it's a huge advantage. It's a huge advantage for both universities and the state of North Dakota that's happening here, because it's also going to help us attract talent. Students from around the country that are interested in this are going to want to come to school here because of the because of what we've got going on. I met a young guy yesterday. He's got 4,500 hours of flight time on drones. Okay, I mean,
that's quite a bit.
It's a lot, and he's a young, very young person. I mean, think of what this person think. And I was just going, where is this guy going in his life? I want almost like, let me follow you around and invest in your next company. I mean, it's exciting to see where we're going.
I call NDSU the brains and UND the body, because they're kind of building the bodies up there. But a lot of people don't understand that North Dakota State is on the forefront of building the opticals and the algorithms, they call them.
Yep.
Explain to me that the brains behind these things being developed at NDSU.
Well, in any one of these, projects, it's maybe too simplistic, but to call it the hardware and the software.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the physical aeronautics ability to get something that flies efficiently. And again, one of the big challenges is the propulsion, the battery life. Because the heavier mm-hmm. your drone, the more juice you have to use to keep the thing up and airborne, and then the less juice you've got to be able to do your data collection, or your flight times are shorter. And so again, it's finding, creating efficient flight so that your payload can be focused on actually doing the data collection. And the data collection again can there are big advances being made, because as we know, if anybody's got a cell phone knows how much better their cameras now than it was, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago. So the advances in, lightweight mobile optics, the advances in what's going on with infrared, reflective light, all of these things, and in some cases we're collecting those images, but we haven't developed the software programs to manage all the data that's coming in. How do we compare, if you take a picture, the same picture of the field once a week over a period of 4 weeks, how do we develop the software that compares the variances between those two, two and three, week two, week three, week four, what's happening, what are the changes, and then creating databases, that information, so that when you go back the next year and the next year, you can compare. On this date, we flew over it, it looked like this, the same time a year later, weather conditions were different. So we'll build up databases of information around what we're observing, and then over the time series we'll get smarter as well. So again, the sooner we start collecting the data, the faster we'll get smarter.
All right, final question for you is anything that I like to give the guest the final word.
Mm-hmm.
That way the questions aren't framed by the host or anything. Anything that you wanted to add about your gubernatorial candidacy or Western North Dakota, or just anything at all?
Well, I think we haven't talked about coal, and so let me just
I'm sorry, yeah, coal.
Let's
yeah.
talk about coal, because coal is super important in North Dakota. Back when I had a chance to work on initially and then later chair Vision 2000, which was a statewide economic development effort, mm-hmm. When we were doing that, I remember, pouring over the economic data of North Dakota, and the two highest GDP counties in the state were our two coal producing counties. The main ones, Beulah, Hays, and Center, Underwood, that whole area was where we're, which is the heart of coal country, and still is. There's 12,000 jobs in the state that are dependent on coal. 80% of our electricity comes from coal. We've got reliable, we've got some of the lowest cost electricity in the nation. And that, it's super important. And here's again where we've had a administration in Washington, D.C., which has really had an anti-coal agenda,
mm-hmm.
is what they've had. And now we're faced with a presidential election where, we got a we're going to end up with Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. And Hillary is anti-coal, anti-fracking, and on her environmental stuff, she's really bad for agriculture too. And so again, I mean, it would be devastating for the North Dakota economy if we're hurting right now. I mean, we have to do everything we can to elect a Republican into the White House next fall and have a pro-energy, pro-business leader in the White House. I mean, what a relief that would be. For North Dakota, and it's why I endorsed Trump when he's going to be the winner of this thing without hesitation, because again, having a business leader in the White House who's pro energy would be great for our state. The alternative, Hillary, would be a disaster, and so charge ahead, go Trump, and I'll do whatever I can to help him get elected.
A lot of people don't understand that. I think it's like 75 to 80%, if not more, of North Dakota energy is powered by coal.
Yes.
And when you take away 1 megawatt of coal, 1 megawatt of wind doesn't replace it. It's like 10 or 20 even times. It's not the same. It's not, right. And I don't think a lot of people understand that.
No.
So anything you want to say to the oil producing counties? Just what does the gubernatorial stance mean to them, I guess?
Well, I hope that they all understand that they know how I understand exactly how important energy is in the state of North Dakota. I mean, over 50% of state revenues coming in have come from the energy industry. Mm-hmm. And we can't education, healthcare, flood protection, law enforcement, anything that we're doing right now in the state of North Dakota, we need to tip our hats and say thanks to the people that have worked to develop the energy resources in the state. And so people can know that not only will I be a champion for energy in the state, but also that Brent Sanford, my running mate, part of the reason I picked Brent was because he's been on the front lines. I mean, he's fourth generation, Watford City, McKenzie County individual, and then he comes back and he's been there through the boom, and now he's been there through the downturn, and he understood that not only do we need great jobs, we have to build great communities. And if you look at what's been accomplished there in terms of not just the infrastructure, but daycare, affordable housing for teachers, the new hospital that's coming, the rec center, the new high school. I mean, when Brent moved home to North Dakota, and his daughter was born here, there were 6 kids that in her age group that were born that year in Watford. There would have been 6 kids in her class without the Bakken. Now there's 120 kids in her class in the Bakken. What he's seen, going through this thing, and it's been 4 decades since we've had anybody in the lieutenant governor, the governor's office, that's got a directly from an oil producing county. And so that's why, I picked Brent. I mean, because I was like, hey, we got to have somebody who's lived through it, who understands this, directly and has, they know the effect that's had on their community, on their family, and Brent's been involved. He's been working, recruiting, oil companies to headquarter and, get, their employment base in Watford City. I mean, he understands it. So that was a key decision. I think people can look, that was really the first decision to get to judge somebody on is, about, how is this, how is a guy who's a business leader, how's a business leader going to view the Bakken? Well, the very first thing I did was I'm going to the Bakken and I'm getting a guy to be my partner. And that guy happens to also be a CPA, because part of this is I got to have somebody who understands we're in a fiscal crisis at the state level. I need a partner that can help us, manage our way through the budget challenge we're going to have. So he's the perfect partner.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Thank you, Jason. You bet.